in 1 Samuel chapter 24 is one of the more famous Bible stories that speaks of the incident where David cut off a piece of King Saul's robe at a time when he could just as easily have killed him. And then that would have ended David's status as a fugitive, and he probably could have taken the throne of Israel for himself right then and there. But he chose otherwise. Now allow me to reiterate the significance of that choice that he made that day. By deciding not to take matters into his own hands, instead allowing God to carry out whatever his plan was in regards to Israel's government, in regards to David's life, many future questions of royal succession and of the role of the divine in establishing Israel's kingly line were answered in the best possible way. Now, this flies right over our modern Western heads, because we're not a tribal-based society. But they, of course, were. Now, the longer I live, I think, the more I travel, especially to other nations, I get to know other cultures, the more I understand that God works within the realities and the limitations of human existence, including that diverse nature of the hundreds of cultures that our planet's population has divided itself up into. It's been the church's unwillingness to accept this attribute of God that's caused so much dissension among believers and driven so many away from Christ into the hands of false religion. Especially the Western church has come to inherently believe, which due to the unprecedented wealth the West possesses, we've been the dominant portion of the church for the past 1,000 years, that the manifestations of God within our Western cultural norms and traditions are the only legitimate manifestations of Christianity. And so all other attempts to observe Christianity are to be ignored, or they're maybe even to be outright rejected as too primitive or simply wrong. But the scriptures show us that the Creator made humans for his own good reasons. He divinely caused the human race to divide, to form a myriad of isolated populations and societies. And in doing so, it automatically created constraints and complexities around how God's redemptive process could even operate. The very nature of our humanity limits the possibilities. It also elevates every probability that most of the time we're going to actually be in opposition to the Lord. In some miraculous, unfathomable way, however, the perfect Father works with the imperfections of humanity to achieve his will. And he does it without steamrolling right over the top of us. But he does it differently within different cultures. God's not interested in perfect uniformity among mankind. He's interested in perfect unity with him. Now, just talk to any missionary who's operated in some of the remotest reaches of this earth, and they'll tell you stories of how the Lord worked within some primitive culture to demonstrate his truth and his glory in ways that those native to that culture could recognize. Ways that seem so strange and so alien to anything that that missionary ever knew or that we generally know of up until that missionary personally witnessed it. Ways that were at times more frightening than odd ways that at first seemed wrong rather than merely different or unexpected. So when we delve deeper into these historical books of the Bible, and especially the time frame of the kings of Israel, realize that Yahweh, at his own choice, is operating within a Middle Eastern tribal culture in ways that they can understand and recognize. Even if it seems now troubling to us. So it was critically important, you see, how David achieved the throne. It was important that it was accomplished in a manner that Israelites and the local Gentile nations in David's day, and then later on, could see as legitimate and God-orchestrated, rather than as some clever result of the plans of a powerful, ambitious man. So let's reread a portion of 1 Samuel chapter 24 to refresh our memories. 1 Samuel chapter 24, if you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 325. We're going to start at verse 8. By saying this, David stopped his men. They wouldn't let them do anything. He wouldn't let them do anything to Saul. Saul got up, left the cave, and went on his way. And then David too got up and went outside the cave, where he called after Saul, "My lord, the king!" And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the ground, and he prostrated himself. And David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to people who say David is out to harm you? Here, today, you've seen with your own eyes that Adonai put you in my power there in that cave. Some of my men said I should kill you, but I spared you. I said, 'No, I won't raise my hand against my Lord because he's Adonai's anointed. And moreover, my father, look, here in my hand you see the corner of your cloak by the fact that I only cut off a piece of your cloak and didn't kill you. You can see and understand I have no plan to do harm or to rebel. I haven't sinned against you, even though you're seeking every chance you get to take my life. May Adonai judge between you and me. May Adonai avenge me on you. But I'll not lay a hand on you. As the old saying has it, out of the wicked come wickedness. So I'll not lay a hand on you. The king of Israel has come on a campaign. After whom? Whom are you chasing? A dead dog? A single flea? Adonai be judge. Let him decide between you and me. May he take my side and rescue me from your power.' And after David had finished speaking to Saul, Saul said, 'Is that your voice, my son, David?' And then Saul cried out and he wept. And he said to David, 'You're more righteous than I, because you have treated me well while I've been treating you badly. You have made it clear to me today that you have done me good. For when Adonai put my fate in your hands, you didn't kill me. A man finds his enemy, he lets him go unharmed. May Adonai reward you well for what you did to me today. Now I'm certain that you will indeed become king, and that the kingship of Israel will be established in your hands. So swear to me by Adonai, you will not kill my descendants after I die, or blot out my name from my father's family.' And David swore to Saul, and Saul went home, but David and his men went back up to the stronghold." Nothing could have been more normal, more usual, considered utterly acceptable, than for a man to kill his enemy if he was given the opportunity. That David did not kill Saul, and then further, he ordered his men not to even bother this evil king, goes against all convention, all logic of that day. Thus, when David at a safe distance reveals himself to Saul and he waves that cut off piece of the king's hem in the air, Saul is stupefied. He's almost speechless. David is allowed to now offer quite a lengthy speech to the king, and he listens in stunned silence. David really didn't have to say too much for the king to understand that as of this moment, he ought to be dead. And David explains, he pleads actually, for Saul to finally understand that David's not his enemy. In fact, in verse 11, David calls Saul my father. And we need to see that this is a very typical piece of Middle Eastern language artistry and thought that's being expressed here. But it also helps us in understanding the language of the New Testament as Yeshua speaks of his speaks of Jehovah as his Abba, his father. And as the Father speaks of Yeshua as his Ben, his son. David is in no way setting Saul on par with his true biological father, Yishai. That Saul was also legally David's father-in-law, that plays somewhat of a role in this. The father-son relationship of biblical Middle Easterns is very similar, actually, to how it still is today. The father holds supreme family authority and esteem, and his son is on a lower level of status. Whatever measure of authority the son is given to him by his father, it can be revoked at any time. The father's supreme authority never ends until that father dies. In the West, for an older man to call a younger man his son or vice versa is usually just a statement of endearment. It's kind of affectionate. In the East, for a younger man to call an older man his father involves equal parts affection and submission. In the East, the younger man who is as a son is under the authority of the man who is as a father to him. It's understood that the father figure looks out for what he sees as the best interests of his son, but the father figure is also revered and wiser. He holds more power. He acts as judge, and generally he lords over his son. This is what David was meaning when he yelled, "My father," to Saul. Now, verse 12 is some more typical Oriental thought. David is calling on Yehovah to be the judge, the shofet, in this dispute between them. The judge is an ancient thought. An ancient thought was also the one, you see, who wrought the punishment on the guilty. In other words, David is saying that whatever wrong Saul might have done towards David, David was satisfied to leave it with God to determine if and how any wrong had occurred. And if it did, it ought to be avenged. But David also states he wasn't going to be our participant in exacting revenge, even if it was called for. It's a way of saying, "I forgive you." However, by saying it in the manner he said it, it saves face for Saul to not be spoken to in terms of forgiveness, which would have automatically indicated that David judged the king of Israel as guilty. Now, a son has no right to judge his father, but the father does have the right to judge his son. Thus, David's insistence that Yehovah be the judge between them solves the problem. Further, David quotes what I guess was just an ancient proverb, out of the wicked comes forth wickedness. And then he goes on to say that no matter what the situation that was, he wasn't going to lay a hand of harm upon Saul. See, now, that's not a biblical proverb. But the point is, it's well understood. It is that deeds express dispositions. If David was a wicked man, then it's self-evident that Saul would have already been a dead man. Therefore, that David didn't harm Saul is de facto proof that David was not the wicked man that Saul thought him to be. And to further make his point that he is more than willing to submit to Saul, based, of course, on the understanding that Saul recognizes David as a son and not as an enemy, David wonders why the great king would lower himself to chase a dead dog like David. See, this is just an expression of ultimate self-debasement. David is holding himself up as insignificant as compared to the importance of King Saul. And after David's long speech, now it's Saul's turn. And Saul is genuinely affected by David's actions and his words. So in verse 16, the king responds, "Is that your voice, my son, David?" And again, while some amount of affection is being expressed by calling David his son, it is done from a position of superiority and authority. It's a kind of acceptance to David's request for Saul to be David's father. But one must also see that tears can flow as a result of self-pity as easily as they can from repentance. I think we can discern without very much difficulty which of those two possible causes it was for Saul's weeping in this case. Yet even so, the emotionally volatile king admits to David that David is more righteous than he. In Hebrew, righteous is tzaddik. Tzaddik. And surprisingly, this is the first use of that term in the book of Samuel. We have to see this as the impact that it would have been on an ancient reader of these words. Samuel was the most revered holy man among all 12 tribes in that era. He was so revered that we'll find reference to him in the New Testament. And he's placed almost on par with Moses. The term tzaddik, righteous, wasn't even applied to the great Samuel. But here, it's applied to David. Remembering that David is the shadow and the type of the future Messiah, this is quite an interesting epithet to bestow on David, especially from the mouth of the anti-king. It is truly a prophetic nugget that we run across here. Then Saul continues by quoting an ancient proverb of his own. If a man finds his enemy, will he let him go unharmed? Only someone who truly fears the God of Israel would behave in such a manner. Saul then admits what Jonathan had already told David about his father. Saul knows that David's going to be king over Israel. The words also mean that David's dynasty will be established. His offspring, the house of David, will rule after David is long gone. And because Saul understands this, and due to the bloody custom of a new king who gains the throne by deposing the former one, of killing the former king and all of his family, Saul asks David to promise him not to kill Saul's children. And when Saul asked David to not blot out his name from his father's family, it means to not bring a complete end to Saul's bloodlines. See, that was considered an absolute horror to the ancient mind, even to a Hebrew, because that meant that King Saul's spiritual essence would end if there was no blood descendant in whom it could be carried forward. David swears this to Saul, and we see David true to his word when he is king and he hunts for any of Saul's descendants, not to kill them, but to show mercy to them. This is when he finds the disabled Mephibosheth, whom he then brings into his own home to care for. The two men part, but in reality, nothing has changed. David removed himself and his men back to the desert oasis of En Gedi, and then Saul goes back to his hometown of Gibeah. David knew all too well King Saul's up and down emotions. His words couldn't be trusted. Given a little time to think things over, the king would pretty soon revert to his paranoia and all of his homicidal self-interest. Let's move on to chapter 25. 1 Samuel chapter 25. Page 326 in the Complete Jewish Bible. Shmuel died. Samuel. All of Israel assembled to mourn him and bury him at his home in Ramah. Then David set out and went down to the Paran Desert. Now, there was a man in Maon who had property in Carmel. He was very rich, having 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. The man's name was Nabal, and his wife was named Abigail. And the woman was intelligent and attractive, but the man was surly and mean in his actions. He belonged to the clan of Caleb. David, there in the desert, heard that Nabal was shearing his sheep, so David sent off 10 young men with these orders. Go up to Nabal in Carmel and bring him greetings from me and say, long life and shalom to you, shalom to your household, shalom to everything that's yours. I've heard that you now have shearers. Your shepherds were with us for a while. We did them no harm, and they found nothing missing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask your own men, they'll tell you. Therefore, receive my men favorably, since we have come on a festive day. Please, give what you can to your servants and to your son David. Now, upon arrival, David's men said all these things to Nabal in David's name, and when they had finished, Nabal answered David's servants, who is David? Who's the son of Yishai? There are many servants nowadays running away from their masters. Am I supposed to take my bread, my water, my meat that I slaughtered for my shears and give it to men coming from who knows where? So David's men turned around and went back and came and told everything Nabal had said him. And David said to his men, buckle your swords on, all of you. Each one buckled on his sword, David too, and there went up after David about 400 men, while 200 stayed with the equipment. But one of Nabal's men told Abigail, his wife, David sent messengers from the desert to greet our master, and he flew on them in a rage, even though the men had been very good to us. They didn't harm us. We found nothing missing during the entire time we went with them while we were out there in the countryside. They served as a wall, protecting us day and night, all the time that we were with them caring for the sheep. So now decide what you're going to do, for clearly harm is on its way to our master, all of his household, but he's so mean that no one can tell him anything. Abigail wasted no time in taking 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already prepared, 6 quarts of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisins, 200 fig cakes, and had them loaded on donkeys. And then she said to her young men, go on ahead of me and I'll come along after you. But she didn't tell her husband Nabal. She was riding her donkey down past the hiding place in the mountain when David and his men descended towards her and she met them. And David had said, what a waste it's been guarding everything this fellow has in the desert so that nothing of his was missing. He's repaid me bad for good. Then he swore, may God do the same and more to David's enemies if I leave alive even one male of everything he owns. And when Abigail saw David, she hurried to dismount from her donkey. She fell on her face in front of David and bowed down to the ground. And having fallen at his feet, she said, "It's my fault, my Lord, it's my fault. Please, let your servant speak in your ears and listen to what your servant says. Please, my Lord, don't pay any attention to this worthless fellow Nabal, because he's just like his name. Nabal means boor, and his boorishness stays with him. But I, your servant, I didn't see my Lord's men whom you sent. Therefore, my Lord, as Adonai lives and as you live, and as much as Adonai has kept you from the guilt of shedding blood and from taking vengeance into your own hands, therefore, may your enemies and anyone seeking your harm be as worthless as Nabal. Meanwhile, let this present, which your servant has brought to my Lord, be given to the men in my Lord's service. And please forgive the offense your servant has caused. Because Adonai will certainly establish my Lord's dynasty. For my Lord fights Adonai's battles, and nothing bad has been found in you all your life long. Even if someone comes along searching for you and seeking your life, your life will be bound in the bundle of life with Adonai your God. But the lives of your enemies, you'll fling away as if from the pouch of a slingshot. Then when Adonai has done all the good to my Lord that he has said about you and made you ruler over Israel, what happens here will not have become an obstacle to you or a cause for remorse to my Lord, neither that you shed blood without cause, nor that my Lord took vengeance into his own hands. Finally, when Adonai has dealt with my Lord, then remember your servant." And David said to Abigail, "Blessed be Adonai, the God of Israel, who sent you today to meet me. And blessed be your tactfulness, and blessed be yourself for having kept me today from the guilt of shedding blood and taking vengeance into my own hands. For as Adonai, the God of Israel, lives, who has kept me from harming you, if you hadn't rushed to meet me, not even one male would have been left to Nabal by morning." So David received from her what she had brought him, and then said to her, "Go up in peace to your home. I've listened to what you have said and granted your request." Abigail came to Nabal. There he was in his house, holding a feast fit for a king. Oh, he was in high spirits because he was very drunk. So she told him nothing, whatever, until the next morning. And in the morning, when he was sober, and his wife told him what had happened, he had a stroke. And he became as motionless as a stone. And some 10 days later, Adonai struck Nabal and he died. And when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be Adonai for having taken my side in the matter of Nabal's insult, for having prevented his servant from doing anything bad. On the contrary, Adonai has called Nabal's bad deeds to return on his own head." Then David sent a message that he wanted to make Abigail his own wife. And when David's servants reached Abigail and Carmel, they said to her, "David has sent us to bring you to him to be his wife." She got up and bowed with her face to the ground and said, "Your servant is here to serve you, to wash the feet of my Lord's servants." Abigail then hurried and set out and rode off on a donkey with 5 of her female servants following her. She went after David's messengers and she became his wife. David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and both of them became his wives. Meanwhile, Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Paltri, the son of Laish, who came from Galim. Now, this is a story about David being saved from himself by a very good and righteous woman named Abigail. Now, it's interesting to me how regularly the Bible elevates women. It's significant because in the typical Oriental society, women were little more valuable than cattle. The God of Israel would not tolerate that kind of attitude among his people. The narrative begins by announcing the death of Samuel. Now, this is important because first it establishes a time frame for when David moved from En Gedi to the wilderness of Paran. And second, because with the passing of Samuel, all hope for peace between David and Saul has now passed with him. Samuel was a transformational character who also bridged the divide of loyalties among all the various tribal coalitions. There was no other single man since Joshua's death who held the respect of all the 12 tribes of Israel and whose authority was honored by all Israel. Even Saul feared him. Samuel was buried in his hometown of Ramah. In fact, you can go visit Samuel's tomb to this day, just minutes outside of Jerusalem. I've been there. And some of your Bibles may say that David went to Maon and not Paran. Paran is taken from the Hebrew texts. Maon is taken from the Greek texts. There's no reason to alter Paran to Maon as some ancient editor did. Paran is to the southeast side of the Dead Sea on the Arabian Peninsula. Ein Gedi was too easily within the reach of King Saul. So David moved. Now the scene of this important story is set in verse 2. A fellow who was currently in Maon had this thriving business in Carmel. He was very wealthy, and this is expressed by the fact that he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. That was a rich man. Now, this is not, by the way, the Mount Carmel that's up in the north. That's where visitors go today. This Carmel was in the territory of Judah, and it was here that Saul had erected a monument to himself to memorialize his victory over Amalek. Now, David had likely met this wealthy man while he and his 600 men were camped out on the outskirts of Maon some months earlier. That his flocks were so enormous meant that they were moved all over Judah in this constant search for fresh pasture and sufficient water. But it was in Carmel where the sheep were taken for shearing, and where he would sell and have a means to trade his wool. This man's name was Nabal. His wife was Abigail. Now, Nabal means fool, disgraceful, a person without any godly wisdom. Now, obviously, no parent was going to give their child that name. No man would allow himself to be addressed by that name. Thus, like so many other names that we'll find in the Bible, this was more an epithet that was given to that person well after the fact. It wasn't that person's actual name. The purpose was to describe this man's character, which of course also identifies now his role in this story. His wife's name, Abigail, means my father is joy, or my father is delighted. So the contrast now is drawn. Nabal and Abigail are opposite in their character. The husband is everything that God detests. The woman is everything that God values. Then in verse 3, we learn that Nabal belonged to the clan of Caleb. This is the same Caleb who, along with Joshua, scouted out the promised land when Moses was still leading Israel, and he came back with a good report about the land, and he urged Moses to take the land. But the other 10 men who accompanied them said that while the land was indeed wonderful in every respect, it was populated with some pretty fierce people, and to try to take it was suicidal. The result was that God cursed these refugees from Egypt, sent them back out into the desert until the first generation of the Exodus died off. The exceptions to that were Joshua and Caleb. Now, Joshua was of the tribe of Ephraim. Caleb was of the tribe of Judah. However, we also learn that Caleb's clan mixed itself with the Kenizzites. This was a Canaanite tribe. And so there was always some friction between Caleb's and the several other clans that formed the tribe of Judah. The clan of Caleb was assigned the area in and around Hebron, if they could capture it, from the Canaanites who were holding it. The area was especially beautiful and fertile. It was perfect for growing crops, for raising animals. This conquest wasn't accomplished until Caleb's younger brother, actually it was his half-brother, Othniel, led some men in battle and then took the city of Hebron for the clan. Well, after all these years now have passed, 3 centuries, we find here in Samuel that the clan of Caleb was still holding on to that area in Hebron, as Nabal was of that clan. And this is the general area that's at the center of our story. Now, verse 4 explains that David heard that sheep shearing of Nabal's flocks had begun. Now, David was out in the Paran wilderness when the word of that reached him. This wouldn't have been unexpected news for a former shepherd. Sheep shearing would have been going on pretty much throughout Canaan. So David dispatches 12 trusted men to go to this Nabal at his shearing operation down in Carmel. And we're going to talk about the significance of the number 10 in due time, but just let me point out that a group of men, of 10 men, is generally called a minyan. A minyan. It's a proper number. It's an ideal minimum of men to form a congregation. Or today, it's the minimum number of Jewish religious men that get together to pray. A minyan. And David sends a message with these men. And of course, it contains typical Middle Eastern greetings and some polite banter. And 3 times the men are to wish shalom over Nabal and his family. Now, this is very friendly. I mean, it's an abundance of goodwill. But contained within this message is a request for supplies as a gift for David and for his small wandering community. It somewhat reminds us of the Godfather movie. When the mobster walks into a shop, he's cordial. He's just effusive in his praise. Oh, what nice apples and what beautiful vegetables you have here. Yes, the business owner for something to be given to him. Now, it may have sounded like a request for a favor, for a blessing, but in reality, it was a demand. All the parties understood that. I'm not doing that. It was something that couldn't be refused without some pretty dire consequences. The mobster's view is that he's protecting the shopkeeper. And so the shopkeeper owed his protectors something in return for their services. Nabal was being strong-armed, despite all this courteous-sounding flattery that was going on here. He knew it. You know what? He didn't like it. He was a powerful man, part of a very powerful clan. He wasn't used to being treated like this. Now, the Hebrew word for sheep shearing is gozezim. Gozezim. Gozezim is the shepherd's equivalent of the harvest and the threshing season. So, we read in verse 8 that this was a very festive day. In Hebrew, it's a Yom Tov. It's a good day. But it was a day of joy and partying and drinking wine that celebrated the harvest of the wool. David's 10 men were essentially some unwelcome party crashers. And after David's men delivered their message, they sat down and they waited for the clan leader's response. It was not what they expected, to say the least. Nabal was offended by this brazen demand. All the polite talk aside, who is this David, this son of Yishai? See, this is a rhetorical question, of course, that basically means, how dare he make such a demand of me? Who does he think he is? Nabal is rich. He's important. Yishai is David's clan and is a rival clan of Nabal's, the clan of Caleb. Nabal's viewpoint is that even if David and his men had helped his shepherds in some way, that it was certainly never asked for, they just volunteered it. Further, he insults David personally by characterizing him as a slave who'd escaped from his master. Well, David's men take Nabal's response to David, and the result's predictable. David loses his temper. He tells his men to put on their swords, prepare for battle. And David left their desert stronghold with 400 men. The remaining 200 stayed behind to guard the camp, all of their belongings from all the ever-present marauders of that area. But Nabal had signed his own death warrant. He's too drunk to realize it, but his wife knew it. And although she wasn't present at her husband's tirade and his impetuous response, someone was, and he came to her, told her everything that had happened. And they explained that indeed David and his men had treated them very well out in the wilderness, and they'd made sure the sheep were protected from both men and wild beasts. In fact, not one animal had come up missing, which was just unheard of. But rather than show gratitude, Nabal issued insults to these men and to their master David, and essentially, he'd now instigated a war. And Abigail knew this was big trouble. And the man who came to Nabal's wife had no qualms in explaining to her what she already knew about her husband. He was mean and stubborn. He listened to nobody. So if Abigail didn't do something, man, a lot of people were going to die, probably her husband too. Actually, in verse 17, the man who came to Abigail said that Nabal was a Ben Belial, a son of Belial. That's about as harsh and blunt a criticism that can be aimed at anybody in that day. That's the worst. Well, what we have here is the makings of a battle of honor. David was going to come to Carmel. He was going to murder Nabal and others in what we today would call honor killings. But thankfully, Abigail was a wise, a virtuous woman who was not about to let a lot of innocent people die over a little bit of food and some rash words if she could stop it. So quickly she takes action, and without her husband's knowledge, prepares this generous peace offering to David. Now her concern, of course, was the continuation of her household. But at the same time, she had the perception, or maybe I should say intuition, to see that David is special in God's eyes, that he's going to hold a set-apart place in Israel's future. So she packs up 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 butchered sheep, about a bushel of dried grain, a whole bunch of raisins and fig cakes. Fig cakes were like just pressed dried figs. And she places them on donkeys in hopes of intercepting David before he arrives at their camp. And she knows that the two biggest kids on the block are just about to face off here. And once Nabal sees David coming, their damaged Middle Eastern sensibilities are just going to take over and nothing's going to stop this torrent of blood that's going to fall. Naturally, she had to do all this in secret. Now, I said at the beginning of this chapter that this is a story about David being saved from himself. David is about to commit a ruinous act that, had it been allowed, might have altered history. The truth is, Nabal had committed no violation of Torah laws, unless we count it as not loving your neighbor as yourself. Nothing more had happened than David figured he was owed something, and Nabal disagreed about that. All that had come between David and Nabal were words. There was no harm done. There was no property stolen. But for this, David was ready, in violent anger, to commit murder. Now, it's so ironic that this story would appear immediately after we find David with a seemingly justifiable, if not a compelling reason, to kill a man, Saul, because this man was intent on killing David. If ever there would have been a good case for self-defense, him killing Saul would have been one. But in paying attention to the Spirit of God, in refusing to take the advice of his men to do that, David spared the life of the king. But here, though, we find David in an out-of-control rage, ready to kill anybody in his path for no other reason than this man had insulted him. So now we're going to see how the all-merciful God stopped this atrocity, not so much for the sake of those who might die as for David's sake and for the sake of God's redemptive plan. What a lesson there is for every man, especially followers of Yeshua. Lest we think too highly of ourselves, no matter how godly our intents might seem to us, our wicked natures always are lurking there, ready to burst out. How often our evil inclinations get in the way of our relationship with God and with our service to Him. Sometimes it's not as blatant as necessarily doing wrong. It's as subtle as choosing a way that's not the way that God's perfect will would have for us. It may not be that we don't prosper from it. Rather, the kingdom of God was meant to prosper from it, and it didn't. Because of our decision. Without our even knowing it, we're constantly invisibly guided, unaware the Lord intervenes in circumstances and indeed. If He didn't, we would all lose our way. We'd destroy the very purpose for which we were born. You didn't get that job you wanted so bad? Perhaps it was the Lord protecting you from failure. You never did amass that wealth that you thought you needed to be happy. Perhaps the Father knew in His mercy that it was more than you could handle and still remain true to Him. That girl you wanted to marry so desperately, who broke your heart when she said no, maybe the Lord has another one. A more perfect spouse for you that's going to help you fulfill your spiritual destiny, one you're not even aware of. David was on his way to commit the terrible sin, a sin that cannot be atoned for with any sacrifice, the sin of blood guilt. It would have been a terrible thing that could have easily destroyed his reputation and his witness. But even more, it probably would have disqualified him from becoming God's anointed king. We'll see what happens next when we meet.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.